Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. How does a wife, mother, and entrepreneur's life change when she's diagnosed with cancer at the age of just 31? Amber Farman joins us around 12:30 to share her life-changing journey and how it's brought about a new passion, as you can imagine, for life and for love. But first, John Burley is the award-winning author of The Absence of Mercy. He was honored with the National Black Ribbon Award for that book. John Burley attended medical school in Chicago and completed his emergency medicine residency at University of Maryland Medical Center and Shock Trauma in Baltimore. And he continues to serve as an emergency medicine physician in Northern California, where he lives now with wife, daughter, and Great Dane. And today we're going to talk about his new book. It's called The Forgetting Place. John Burley, welcome.
Thank you, Vicki. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's my pleasure. I was just saying I enjoyed reading the book yesterday because I was down at the beach. All nicely tucked up in my snow coat and my Uggs and my gloves, but the weather was just so beautiful. You had to be outdoors yesterday, so it was a perfect environment for it.
Exactly. It's a good place to read the book, I think.
Yeah. So this is your second book. How did a medicine physician become an author? Let's start with that. I read somewhere that you'd always wanted to write a book. When you were 10, you thought you were going to be a novelist.
Exactly. You know, I got into reading fairly early, and I started out sort of reading the Hardy Boys mystery series, and that sort of got me interested in the genre of mystery. And then I graduated on to works of Stephen King and Dean Koontz and got interested in sort of the dark and macabre genres. And ever since that point, I felt like I'd love to get my hands on a book and see what I could do with a novel. It's a long road through medical school and residency, and so it doesn't allow much time for writing novels, and so I put that on hold during that time. But once I finished with residency, I had a little bit of a respite, and I thought that, you know, if there was any time that I was going to do this, I should get started on it then. And so I sort of set to work, started writing the first chapter, and just saw where that went. And at the end, you know, when you're finished for the day, you think you've done something really, really great, and then you go back the next day and reread it, and you realize you've got a lot of work to do. So it's a humbling experience. I think in my mind, I just thought the words would flow without any work or difficulty. And what I found very quickly is that writing is hard work, and it continues to be a humbling experience throughout.
Yeah, I think many authors would say the same things. I think it's maybe a sign of an amateur or somebody naive who goes, oh, it's just easy. But I guess to some people it is easier. But I think Ernest Hemingway said there's nothing to it. It's just like sitting down at a typewriter and slitting open a vein or something like that.
Exactly. And you know, I've heard the quote that, you know, I spent all day writing six words, getting six words on a paper. And that's not so bad. That's progress, but I have no idea which order the words go in. So,
well, kudos to you for not getting just one done, but two while you're working also as a medicine physician. So tell us a little bit about the book, because this is an exact follow-on? Because I didn't see the first book at all.
Right. So this is not a sequel to the first book. Both of my novels are standalone novels, so they're separate stories, separate characters. The Forgetting Place takes place at a correctional psychiatric facility on the banks of the Severn River in Maryland, where I grew up. And it involves a psychiatrist, Dr. Lee Shields, who works at that facility. This is a place where people are designated to stay long periods of time. These are people who have committed heinous crimes but have been deemed by the judicial system to either not be fit to stand trial or have been deemed not guilty by reason of insanity. And so these are patients at a psychiatric hospital who are there for the long haul. And Dr. Shields works there, and she has a fairly routine life, you know, working at the facility. But she comes in contact with a new patient that arrives there with no paperwork, no real explanation of why he's there. And she starts to become suspicious about the fact that he is there, and maybe that he's not there for the right reasons. Perhaps he was put there to keep him quiet about a crime that involved him, or perhaps that there's some sort of cover-up. So she starts investigating the situation, and as she does, she becomes more and more concerned about the safety of her patient and the safety of herself, and her efforts are stymied by the hospital administrator and other people that she comes in contact with.
And so your protagonist, Lee Shields, as you said, Dr. Lee Shields, is a 33-year-old psychiatrist, right? She describes it as a lonely profession. So tell us a little bit about her character and how difficult for you was it to write from a woman's perspective?
Well, I had a little help in that my wife is a psychiatrist, and so she was able to give me some insights on the profession. I went through residency with her and sort of watched what she went through in her training process. And it does seem to me that, although I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm an emergency medicine physician, it does seem to me that psychiatry can be a somewhat lonely profession in that you spend a lot of time talking with people about their problems, sort of uncovering their demons. And this information is all, of course, confidential, bound by doctor-patient confidentiality, and so you really can't open up and have much of an avenue for venting yourself with your contacts. And so you sort of have to sit with and hold a lot of secrets and a lot of angst and find something to do with that other than talking with others about it. So in that realm, I think psychiatry can be a somewhat lonely profession. And Dr. Shields had an interesting upbringing. She, as we'll learn over the course of the book, she lived in a household in which her mother suffered from depression. Her father was somewhat overbearing. And during a particular summer, they had an uncle of hers come and stay with them, and her uncle had schizophrenia. So she was affected by that relationship from a very young age and got to see firsthand some of the ravages that disease can cause.
Mm-hmm. So many things, I think, inspire writers to run off with a story. What inspired, was there a particular point of inspiration around this story that sparked the idea for this story?
Well, I've always been interested in mental illness just because I talk about it so frequently through my wife's work. And I've been interested not only in the patients and the anguish that they endure, but also how it affects their families. And so with Lise as a young child, she comes in contact with this uncle of hers who she adores, but is very ill. And that plays out on the course of her life, maybe inspires her to become a psychiatrist in the first place, but also scars her in various ways. And so I think that the impetus for this story was an idea of exploring the familial relationships of those with mental illness and how it affects the people that they love and that love them.
Mm. So I want to go back a little just to writing from a female POV, because I've talked with several authors, male authors, who do this. One wrote his whole book, like a three-book series, in the male perspective, and his editor and agent and publisher were like, no, we need to make this main character a woman. So
just a minor change,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but it was very successful. So they knew, you know, they knew what they were talking about there.
Yes,
I'm wondering, you know, do you kind of try and get into the how do you get into the psyche there? I know your wife's a forensic psychiatrist, and she's going to help you out with that perspective. But as you're writing this, what goes on? What kind of process goes on for you?
Well, I think in whatever voice you choose to write in, what you really have to do is just submerge yourself in the reality of that particular character. And so what I tried to do was I imagined myself as Dr. Shields working at this correctional facility and how that would make me feel and what kind of a life a person who dedicates their lives to these patients might have, and also what sort of things may have driven them to that profession. And so I try to write from that perspective. I try to sort of lose myself a little bit and just take on the persona of that character. And of course, as a male author writing in a female voice, there are some things that we're probably not going to get correct, and that's the beauty of having a spouse or
right.
an editor to point to things and say, a woman would not see that this way. You're looking at it as from a male perspective, and I think that's invaluable to have your work read by other people and to have them put you back on track in a few cases where you sort of start to get off track.
Right. Well, Lisa Unger, New York Times bestselling author of Crazy Love You, said that The Forgetting Place is a deep dive into the darkest recesses of the human psyche. Surprises wait at every turn. And the book, again, is The Forgetting Place. We are talking with the author, John Burley. We're going to take a very quick break and we'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to NuPro Supplements, we cover the world of animals. This week, March 1st, it's Shelter, Rescue Sanctuary, and anything that helps our animal friends Sunday. We'll check on our regulars, birds, and horses. We'll pick up where we left off with Elaine Fortgang from Friends of Woodland Park Zoo Elephants, find out the latest on the zoo's plans to close the exhibit and move the elephants, and propose legislation to make the zoo more transparent. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Seattle-based forensic psychologist and author Jay Richards discusses his new psychological thriller, Silhouette of Virtue, and British historian and author of The Favourite, Riley and His Queen, Matthew Lyons, separates fact from fiction by exploring the belief held by some that Henry VIII heir, Elizabeth I, was in fact a man. See more at conversationslive.net. And don't forget to tune in every Monday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
For the people, by the people. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is John Burley. He's the award-winning author of The Absence of Mercy, which also won the National Black Ribbon Award, recognizing a new voice in suspense writing. But we're talking about John's second book today, The Forgetting Place. And the Publishers Weekly said it's an impressive psychological thriller. Burley, himself a physician, renders the manifestations of psychological illness in such a way that both Lise and the reader must confront the terrifying nature of reality itself. So let's talk a little bit about, that you like to do research. And this actually was talking about your first book, but I know you've had to do research for your second book too. So tell me about some really unusual ways that you've had to go approach research, or something that's been really weird. Other than going out in the middle of a lake in the middle of the night, I read you.
Right, you read that little
tongue in cheek, yeah.
Sure. So, you know, writers are supposed to write about what they know. And so I know medicine, and a lot of, both books that I've written have physicians as the protagonists, have physicians as the voice of either of narration in the second book or the protagonist in the first book. And so I try to draw from those experiences. For The Forgetting Place, when I was going through medical school, I spent 6 weeks at spent time at was Elgin Mental Health Center, which is a 582-bed correctional psychiatric facility for patients who have essentially been deemed incompetent to stand trial or not guilty by reason of insanity. And so you spend 6 weeks at a place like that. It really gives you a feel for what that place is like and what it's like for the people taking care of the patients and for the patients themselves. So I think I was able to draw on that for the creation of this story. My wife also did her residency at University of Maryland, and one of the hospitals that she rotated through is Shepherd Pratt Hospital in Baltimore, which has this very beautiful sort of sprawling oak-studded campus. And I tried to use some of the imagery from that in the portrayal of Menaker State Hospital, where the forgetting place takes place.
Mm. So place, the sense of place, is actually another character, really, in your book, right?
Absolutely. I you know, present many characters, but one of the characters that is essential to the story and has a strong voice of its own is the hospital itself, that this is a hospital that houses people for long periods of time, has been around for many, many decades, and has its own story to tell and its own personality. And Lisa talks about that throughout the novel. And actually, we get a fairly good sense of that even in the opening chapter as she describes the hospital and the general mood that permeates the facility.
Right. And so let's talk a little about dialogue, because this is something that makes me throw a lot of books up the wall and stop reading. Because it often sounds so stilted, or they're trying to expose too much in a conversation, and you feel like you're being lectured to. It just comes to a screeching halt for me. But you did a great job with dialogue. So tell me how you approach dialogue.
Well, and thank you for the compliment. That's very kind of you. A dialogue is hard. Dialogue, I think most writers wrestle with dialogue because it should come across as two people speaking and not come across as you writing words on a page or you trying to sort of do an information dump, if you will, and get all the information across to the reader right away, that you have to present the information in such a way that it's in small chunks and it's palatable and comes across as realistic. If you and I are talking and I go on and on for, 30 minutes about some subject without taking a breath, you're going to zone out, and I think the reader will also do the same when they're reading that passage. So you have to just be careful. And also you have to write your dialogue in such a way that people actually speak. One comment that someone had mentioned during a recent book event that I had was how difficult it is to write dialogue because you end up writing it too formally. You end up presenting it in a way that is just not true to the way people talk to one another. And so you have to guard against that as well.
Right, because in real life, we bounce all over the place.
Of course.
And so you've got to get that balance there that makes sense in the book, but sounds really natural. It is difficult. You're right. So I want to read a little from the book here and ask you if this is something you believe yourself or if this is just your character speaking. It's from Dr. Lise Shields' point of view. And she says, one can travel to the Far East, study particle physics, get married, raise a child, and still, in all that time, we're never too far from where we first started. We belong to our past, each of us serving it in our own way. And to break the tether between that time and the present is to risk shattering ourselves in the process.
Right. So this is the opening chapter of The Forgetting Place, and Lise is describing how she did her training in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins Hospital, and many years later, after all that training, here she is at a hospital only a few miles from where she trained. And she sort of is talking about this idea that we're never really too far from where we first started. And so I do believe that in some ways. I think that we're all shaped by our early years, by our early friendships and relationships and our childhood. And we can go on to do a lot of things, and we become adults, and we get married perhaps and raise our children, and we maybe move to another part of the world entirely. And we have this illusion that we have reinvented ourselves. We're no longer tied to those things that shape were so pivotal in shaping us at an early age. And I think in many cases, that is an illusion, that we are still the product of our environment from that early age. And I think it's important to realize that the friends that we make when we're children tend to be some of our, you know, best friends. Those are people that we have friendships with throughout our lives, and we may not speak to them for years and years, and yet when we pick up the phone, it's like we never really mm-hmm. hung up.
Yeah.
And so I think I wanted to sort of give voice to that concept.
Yeah. You said that the idea for your first book came shortly after the birth of your own daughter, and you commented that almost any parent can will attest to this. I've certainly heard it myself and many times, even though I'm not a parent. I've heard people say there is a fundamental change that occurs within them when they have a child born. And you say it's something to do with a sense of newfound responsibility and purpose, yes, but also something more basic, more primitive. Like what?
Well, I think that one of the things that you encounter is this amazing insight that you would do anything to protect the child in front of you, that this is a human being who did not exist, you know, the day before, and the day that they're born, everything changes. I mean, you are there to raise them, to protect them, and you are there to see them through whatever life has to deal them. And so that is a fairly profound change in yourself as a parent, and suddenly you don't have your own best interest in mind as a paramount feature of your life. That the most important thing is the safety and the well-being of that child. And
yeah.
So we're almost instantly changed at the moment of birth, and that sticks with us for the entirety of our lives. Even once our children become adults, we care deeply about what happens to them, and that we place them above ourselves.
Mm. And so I'm guessing you get a lot of inspiration from your child. But what as a writer inspires you, John?
What
inspires you as a writer?
As a writer, life and relationships. You know, I think those are the things that I find most interesting. The relationships that we have with one another. Certainly, my relationship with my daughter and my wife have inspired me quite a bit in my writing, and also those relationships that I have with people that I work with, my friends, and you know, we live in a world in which our relationships can become very complicated, and they're not always, you know, the things that are uplifting. Sometimes we go through difficult times together, but the idea is that we go through these things together,
right.
And I've tried to touch on that in both novels. That, you know, we in both novels, the characters, they go through a lot of pain and suffering, and they struggle, but they struggle together. And so I think that's what we all do.
Yeah. So I read that it took you 3 years to write the first book, another 3 years to get it published, and then it wins an award. What kind of did you feel pressure in writing the second book? Did you feel pressure too?
Well, you know, just a little bit. You know, the beautiful thing about writing a debut novel is that there is no contract, there is no publisher, there is no agent, and you're just writing it on the side. You know, whenever you have a spare moment, maybe you sit down and put a few hours in, and then you may not go back to write again for several days or even several weeks, and so there's no pressure at all. And then once you and that whole time you're hoping for you know a contract, you're hoping to have a publisher that likes your work and embraces what you have to say and takes you in. And that's such a long uphill battle. It doesn't happen overnight. It takes a long time. And once you do get that contract, it's one of those things where, you know, you're so ecstatic. It's such a high to finally have made it there. But at the same time, like most successes, the flip side of achievement is fear, and you realize that, oh my goodness, now, you know, there's pressure. Now there's people that have expectations, and I have a contractual obligation to write the second book in a certain period of time. And my first book took three years to write. My second book took 9 months.
Wow.
And I was working the same amount, you know, as a ER doctor the whole time. So it was it, it's do I find time to write? And I think it's like anything that you love. You know, you find time to do the things that you love. And I excuse me, I really enjoy the writing process, and it's a hobby. I look at it as a hobby, and it's something that gives me a lot of fulfillment. And so I go back to it in the same way one might go back to long hikes in the woods or skiing expeditions or surfing here in California. And so it makes it not so much work, but and spending time with something that you really enjoy.
Yeah, it sounds as though you enjoy it. I'm guessing it's quite a nice escape and a different pace from the emergency room that you work into.
Yeah. I mean, it helps me use a different part of my brain. And it also, I think, gives me an appreciation for going back to the ER and stepping through those doors, because it can be, of course, stressful and difficult to work in that environment. But the one thing, I mean, I really enjoy my work as an ER doctor, and the one thing that I enjoy most of all is the relationship that I have with the nurses and fellow physicians and physician assistants that I work with. They're amazing people who, you know, inspire me every day, and to spend some time writing for a few days, and then to go back and step through the doors of the emergency department is like coming home.
Right.
And so I get to spend time with people, which is something that many writers don't have an opportunity to do as much as they would like.
Right. Well, I really appreciate you being with us today. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Kirkus Reviews says Burley deftly twists his psychological thriller, threading his tale with clues that add up to a stunning revelation, dark, intricate, and compelling. I'd agree with them. The book is called The Forgetting Place. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, John?
Well, My books are a dark psychological suspense, and so I try to present a story that'll get your heart racing, but I also want to leave you at the end of the day with something to think about. And so I hope that if you decide to pick up one of my books, you'll not only enjoy it, but have ample material for discussion with other people that have read the book. And so I appreciate people picking up a book and spending time with it, and I wish all my readers the best.
Great. And very quickly, I saw a schedule on tour, but you're not coming up here to Seattle. Did we miss you when you were up here in Seattle?
Well, we have Left Coast Crime, which is coming up in March, and so I actually will be speaking with a few other authors at Palace Bookstore during that time. So it should be on my website. If you take a look at the www.john-burley.com, I try to post all my events, and then also on Amazon I have a list on my author page of different events that I'm scheduled to do.
Okay, so john-burley.com, john-burley.com is the website. You can find out more there. The book is The Forgetting Place, and my guest, of course, John Burley. Thanks for being with us, John. Please do stay with us. We will be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7000. 7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Going against the grain has never been so much fun. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And in this segment, we're going to talk with somebody whose journey brought about many changes in her life, and including a new passion for life and a new passion for love. She's Amber Farman. She's an entrepreneur who in 2001 opened her first business and continues to successfully run that business today. She lives in Northern California with her husband, and this is her description: 4 kids, 2 goats, a goat, a pig, and the best golden retriever ever. She's the author of Farewell, My Loves, and is joining us today to talk about a journey that began for her in 2009 at the age of 31. So I'm going to bring her on and we'll talk about that in her own words. Amber Farman, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's a very interesting journey that you have to share with our listeners. And you went through this journey at a very young age. You, at the age of 31, I understand, received a diagnosis of breast cancer, and a few months later elected to have a double mastectomy. So tell us a little bit about what happened there. Where were you at in your life? You're just going along and thinking, enjoying life, and what happened?
Exactly. I am just raising my 4 children. I'm the working mom, you know, trying to juggle everything until I felt a lump. I was actually at a massage, go figure, just getting a wonderful massage for my birthday, and that's when I felt the pain for the first time. And a typical mom, I think, oh, it's nothing. I have my 4 kids I have to worry about. So I let some time pass, and a lesson learned to never, to always, you know, if there's something wrong, you probably need to go check it out.
Mm-hmm. So you felt a lump and there was pain with it. You know, I can't remember who I was talking with. They said you rarely feel pain with breast cancer, but until of course it's really got hold of you.
Right. You know, I've always heard that too. You know, and honestly, at 31, sad to say, I wasn't doing monthly breast exams. I really wasn't. You think you're just immortal? I just never would have thought it would be me. I have no family history. But the more I learned, so what happened was I did have pain. I actually started having throbbing pain, even with the seatbelt coming over me in the car. So I remember driving for months holding the seatbelt away from my breast. Mm. So I am thankful that I had pain. And actually, come to find out, talking to other women who have had breast cancer, a lot of them had pain too. You know, you think of a tumor growing, and sometimes it might just put pressure on a nerve. that was maybe, I think, what was happening with me. And thankfully, because I would have never, never, ever paid attention if I did not have pain.
Yes, thank goodness you felt that pain. So it ended, you decided to have a double bilateral mastectomy. Was that the only choice to you? Was that a personal choice? How did you come to that decision?
Immediately, I knew, well, let's just cut them off, is basically what I kept telling myself. Let's just get rid of them if they're trying to hurt me. But it was actually a harder decision than I thought it would be. I had one surgery first. I had a lumpectomy first, and they just could not get all the cancer. And that, after that surgery, it left me physically, I mean, I looked very physically different. And so that's when I just had to make that decision, okay, rather than have another try at this, let's just remove them completely and then start over.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a personal decision. It was at the recommendation, with my age being so young, with the amount of cancer that I had, it was definitely on the table, and it was the best decision after going to three different doctors for me. It was the best decision, and I don't regret it. Even looking at the scars every day, I mean, seeing them, I don't regret it. It was what I needed to do.
Right. And this was 2009. So you've now gone past your 5-year mark.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And cancer free, which is great news.
Yes, cancer free.
And you elected to have reconstructive surgery, which I've talked with several people who've gone through this, and they've said that in itself is a major decision to make, and they had very mixed feelings about it. How did you feel about it? Why did you elect to have it?
I think that I was still so young. I think if I was maybe older, I don't think I would have, looking back. It was not an easy time. It was really painful. But because I was so young, I just decided to go for it. And again, you know, everybody has to make their own choices. And I'm really glad I did now. I mean, I love it. I actually, you know, after having kids, I feel like, wow, I look better now in outfits than I did before. But, you know, that kind of sounds vain. But, you know, I always try to look at the positive in things.
Right, right.
So I am glad that I did it. I still feel very feminine. But if I was older, I think I wouldn't have done it. So I think it was just maybe my age and being 31 and still having a lot of years to live ahead.
Right, so, right. Now, you've written this book called Farewell, My Loves, which is a novel. It's not autobiographical, but there's definitely some crossover there. But I understand you came up with the idea for the novel in 2007. Is that correct? And then you got your own diagnosis in 2009.
Yes, that is correct. And it's a very eerie thing. I did get the idea randomly one night. I'm in a bathtub. And now looking back, I think I was already sick. I just didn't know. I was having these chills, like really bad chills every single night, like where my body would shake.
Mm-hmm.
And one night in the bath, I'm just sitting there and this whole story plot comes to me about a mom with cancer having to say goodbye to her family and just all this stuff. And like a crazy woman, I literally jump out of the bathtub, running down the hallway, trying not to slip on the hardwood floor, whispering, yelling, because my kids were sleeping, like, I have it. I've got my story. I can write a story now. And I never would have imagined 2 years later that my character, Meredith, in the story would parallel my life so much.
Now, were you actually, how much of the book had you written when you got your diagnosis?
I was deep into character development. I was probably, I would say, about halfway through. I was well on my way, saw like the ending. I was well on my way with this project.
Right.
As much as I could, juggling my kids. But Robert, the Meredith, the main characters were there and ready. The kids were there. They were all written and the story was going.
And so in the book, part of the journey of the character Meredith, who's the one with breast cancer, part of her journey is she decides to search for a new wife for a husband, wife/mother for her kids. Is that something what, you know, since you'd already written this, were you kind of going through that yourself? Were you thinking about that yourself at some point?
Absolutely. Absolutely. This whole story made me think of myself the whole time. Like, what would I do? What would I want for my kids? What would I want to say to my kids? And I'm a control freak, I'll be honest. Everybody knows me will probably say.
I did kind of think that was a bit controlling, you know. I'm going to pick out your new wife.
Well, I'm a planner, and I just want everybody to be okay.
Right.
I'm like the party planner, and I do the vacations, and I just want to make sure everybody's happy, healthy, and going to be okay. And so, you know, honestly, when I first got this diagnosis, I had to stop writing altogether. I had to put it down. I just couldn't write anymore because I thought, oh my gosh, I've written my destiny, and how am I going to say goodbye to my family?
Mm.
And it took me at least a year and a half to start writing again. But what was missing with the first draft of the story was the raw emotion. So then it took on a turn all of its own. There All My Loves really took a different turn.
Right.
And a lot of what's in the book now, I mean, I did a whole rewrite, and it really made it more personal for my life and the emotions. And even after writing, sometimes I would literally just be like sobbing and like need 20 minutes just to like, okay, all right, let's go again. Just because it was so personal. Meredith, you know, Meredith taught me, my character in my book taught me how to find peace in death, because, you know, it is going to find us all one day. So I am grateful.
That's
in
for
that
sure.
Sense.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about some of those emotions you went through and how you discussed this with family, and some of the joys that have come from this, because the flip side is that you did find a renewed passion for life and love. So we'll talk about that when we come back. The novel is Farewell, My Loves. My guest is Amber Farman. And you are listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please do stay with us.
I want to thank my mommy for loving me so much.
For taking me to the doctor when I broke my foot.
For leaving me alone when I wanted to be alone.
And now, as a grown-up, I'm thankful for being able to take care of you, my dear mom. For taking you to your therapies. For understanding that sometimes you simply want to be alone.
Roles change without us noticing. That's why AARP gives you the information to provide even better care for your loved one. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations, both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Seattle-based forensic psychologist and author Jay Richards discusses his new psychological thriller, Silhouette of Virtue, and British historian and author of The Favorite, Riley and His Queen, Matthew Lyons, separates fact from fiction by exploring the belief held by some that Henry VIII heir, Elizabeth I, was in fact a man. See more at conversationslive.net. And don't forget to tune in every Monday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to help you heal and stay healthy.
The search is over. You found the station that's not afraid to be different. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Amber Farman. She's an entrepreneur, wife, mother, and in 2009, she was diagnosed at the age of 31 with breast cancer. Just 3 or 4 months later, she elected to have a double bilateral mastectomy and reconstructive surgery. She's now cancer-free. But along the way, she wrote a novel that parallels somewhat of her life. It's called Farewell, My Loves, and we're talking today about some of her emotional and spiritual journey. And Amber, I wanted to ask, because I've heard this from so many people, that sometimes husbands just are so wonderful and others just don't get it and don't know how to respond because they're so used to trying to fix things. And, you know, and then they have their own set of emotions to deal with because they can't, it's not something they can fix, right?
Right.
How did you cope with your husband? How did he cope with this?
You know, it was amazing, I have to say. It really brought us closer together. He surprised me in many ways. He just began to take care of everything, from the dishes to running the kids around. He really got to experience and took on wholeheartedly my duties as a mom. You know, we try to juggle it all, the laundry, the work, and everything. He was really supportive. He was really loving. I mean, I'll tell you one moment that I'll never forget was the day my bandages came off after my bilateral mastectomy. And I didn't realize how emotional I would get. And I remember sitting in the office, and there was a doctor and a nurse there, and actually there was two doctors. And I remember the sob from deep within just started bubbling out, and I just the feeling of it, just when the bandages came off, I just knew I didn't feel like a woman anymore. I just felt like I was, my body was just ravished, and I was angry, and I just remember sobbing, and I hate crying in front of people, but my husband was just in the chair next to me, and they wanted to, you know, ask me if I wanted to look in the mirror. I just couldn't even talk. I could barely breathe. I was just sobbing. And he just took my hand. He looked in my eyes. He said, "I will always love you. You are beautiful no matter what."
Aww.
And I remember that moment was just like, I never, we'd always joke with each other, "Do you love me today? I love you today. Do you love me?" and I just remember now, I don't ever have to ask. He was with me every step of the way at appointments. When in my darkest hour, when I was just crying and woe is me, for, you know, for a few minutes, he was always there for my rock and for our kids, you know, even being open with them when I couldn't be open. I didn't want to tell them all of everything. He would sit the kids down. So for me and my spouse, he was really my rock during that time.
And that's the way it should be. That's the way we would hope it would be for everyone. That's awesome. So I want to ask you, you grew up in the church. You had dreams at one point of becoming a missionary. You chose to walk away from the church altogether. At what point did that happen, and how did facing your own mortality change the way you saw, the way you used to think about religion and the church?
Right. I think when you wonder, there's a part in cancer, it's called the waiting room, where there's a few weeks in your treatment that you just don't know your future. You don't know if it's all over your body. You just don't know what's happening. And when I was really honest with myself, you know, you're right. I grew up in the church from day one. My husband and I, we fell in love on the missions field. We actually fell in love in Africa. I always believed I would be a missionary. But when you really face death and you really stop and pause and think about it, for myself, I just couldn't 100% say I knew exactly where I was heading after I would breathe my last breath. I just, if I was truly honest, I just couldn't say for 100% certainty I knew exactly where I was going. So then it just kind of took me on a whole new journey. And it definitely wasn't overnight walking away from the church. It was many years. It was becoming a mother. It was, what am I going to teach my own children? What's the legacy I want them to have? I want to teach them empathy. And there was just so many things in the church that I just couldn't answer. And I couldn't say that I knew for truth 100%. And that's just when I finally had to step away and realize that we can be spiritual. I can still have faith in things, but I don't have to go to an organized group to get that.
Right, right.
And it's not easy. I will tell you, I feel very much like the black sheep of my family. It has not been an easy thing at all for our family. But at the same time, I've never been so happy in all my life.
Well, that's good. You know, we have these wake up calls in life, and I mean, that one is a huge one, to hear the big C word, as they call it. That's a huge wake up call. And some people still don't wake up from that. So it's good that you've had this experience. I want to talk about living life for others versus yourself. You talk about, you know, living a scripted life. You talk about breaking free from the box society has created for you. In the book, you explore same-sex relationship or feelings for somebody of the same sex, even though your character is married. Polyamorous relationships. Talk to us about how you see the rules that society makes for us and breaking away from those.
Right. I think society has just set up things. There's marriage. We're told at a very young age for women, you know, you're going to marry your Prince Charming one day, and to be taken care of for the rest of your life. And I think part of stepping away from the church and stepping away from all these things that I was taught from such a really ingrained in me since a little child, stepping away from all that and really looking at things differently has opened up a whole new world for me. And it's allowed me to step away from a society and say, you know, just to question everything. I think part of questioning faith and religion makes you then step back and question everything, at least for me in my life. And so I think that's where it all began, is who am I living my life for? Am I living my life to please the neighbors down the street, to please my parents, to please the church, to please, you know, everybody around me? Am I supposed to follow these rules that have been set up? Or can I be really truthful to myself and my authentic self and be who I really want to be? Because living for me and the love of my family and knowing who I am, it just has been a really freeing thing. And so I don't think that we have to live by society's how they want us. I think everybody has their own truth in them.
Right.
And to find that own truth is a journey. But if you can let that go, let go of the Joneses and let go of what your parents expect for you and start really living your authentic life, I feel like you're going to be so much more happier.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to be living the life that you've always dreamed of. And so that's why this book really explored a lot of polyamory relationships. I got to question everything, and now I get to make up my own rules, my life rules, and how I want to live my life. And I think for everybody, you know, I think polyamory relationships probably work for some people. Absolutely. And I think that as humans, we all just want a connection with someone. We want to give love and be loved.
Yes.
And sometimes that comes in all different kinds.
Yeah. My first guest would echo that, because when we were chatting during the break, he said that your segment sounded interesting coming up, and he as an EMT, emergency physician in the emergency room, said all people really want is that connection. So I thank you so much for being with us and sharing your very personal story with us, Amber. The book is called Farewell, My Loves. You can find more about Amber at amberfarman.com, amberfarman.com. And we will be back next week with a live news show. You can find me until then at 1-800-495-7617, 800-495-7617, or at info@conversationslive.net. You can also find me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair and on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Again, thanks for being with us. And if you have any questions or feedback on today's show, drop me a line. Happy to respond to you. We'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.